Welcome to A Cult of Personality at acultofpersonality.net. Thank you for listening.
Welcome to A Cult of Personality, esoteric podcast extraordinaire. Peering behind the veil to provide you with recorded interviews with esoteric teachers and scholars from all over the world. I'm your host, Greg Kaminsky. Welcome back. This is podcast episode 130, featuring an interview with Rubophilos Safluere, who most recently authored The Hermes Paradigm, Book 2, The First Work, published by Salamander and Sons. You can find A Cult of Personality online at acultofpersonality.net, which features an extensive archive of recordings. Just click the available shows link on the website. A Cult of Personality podcast is made possible by you, the listeners and subscribers to the A Cult of Personality membership section. Your support allows for the continuation of free recorded podcasts and the publicly available archive. If you're not already a subscriber to the membership section, please take a moment to click the link on the sidebar of the website or browse to occultofpersonality.net/membership and peruse the available content. Access to everything is only $7.95 a month, and there's no obligation. It's a great way to support independent media. You can also support the show and sponsor an episode by donating via the PayPal donate button on the website. This episode is sponsored by Joseph Uccello of Viatorium Press, Steve M., Thomas W., and Dream Cycle Creations, vendor of tarot cards, divination tools, and magical implements at dreamcyclecreations.com. Thanks again. Now, in episode number 130, our guest is Rubophilos Safluere, the author of The Hermes Paradigm, Book 2, The First Work, published by Salamander and Sons. Rubophilos was our guest previously in podcast episode number 88. And remember to check the show notes for links to Rubophilos' previous appearance, his website, and to purchase his books from Salamander and Sons. Now for a little brief background. Rubophilos Safluere began his nine-year alchemical apprenticeship in 1988 under the private instruction of Frater Albertus Spagyricus, last active New Zealand graduate. By 1990, he had founded a small alchemical study group whose aim is the preservation and further development of the knowledge that he inherited from his teacher. Today, that group continues to serve as a vehicle for private tuition and collaborative research. During the past 20 years, Rubophilos has been a member of a number of respected esoteric organizations, including AMORC, BOTA, the Hermetic Order of the Golden Dawn, the Philosophers of Nature, and Freemasonry, holding prominent offices and ranks in some of these institutions. Originally trained as a neo-Jungian therapist and running a private practice during the mid-1990s, his skill in the field of human psychology has allowed him to open doors into little-understood avenues of the inner alchemical work. Today he lives in Hawke's Bay, New Zealand, focusing upon his writing, ongoing teaching, and research commitments. I highly recommend Rubophilos' books and have found him to be the clearest, most concise, and effective teacher of alchemy that I have ever encountered. My own rudimentary understanding has grown tremendously since I've become acquainted with his work. Rubophilos, I want to welcome you back to A Cult of Personality podcast. It's a pleasure and an honor to speak with you once again.
Thanks very much for doing an interview for the second book.
Yeah, it's my pleasure. And again, the second book is The Hermes Paradigm, Book 2, The First Work, published, of course, by Salamander and Sons. Tremendous book. And I want to take a moment again to thank you for mentioning me and A Cult of Personality in the acknowledgments to the book. I was really touched by that and very much appreciate it.
Oh, you're very welcome. The last podcast we did together has been really helpful to us because we've had a lot of feedback from it particularly in the last year, as the word sort of got round about your website and about that podcast in particular. And I know a lot of people have been curious about who I am and things like that, being in New Zealand at the other end of the world. You were one of the first people I thought of when I decided to sit down and write who I was going to give the acknowledgements for, because it was a great help to us.
Oh, thank you. And it's wonderful to hear. And I know that that interview is definitely one of the most popular ones on the website. And I'm glad to be able to speak with you again on the occasion of the release of your second book, Book 2 of the Hermes Paradigm, the first work. Maybe before I start asking you specific questions about the book, you might want to just give us a brief idea of your intention in writing it. I know this is a series of books, and each one is geared toward a specific aspect of the work, but maybe you could just briefly tell us about this one.
Okay, so there's 5 books in the series altogether. 3.5 of them have been written so far, so we're waiting for the third one to be published. And they're all set out in a manner which alchemy is normally taught formally in the 20th and 21st century, on the basis of how Frater Albertus laid out the training course of things. So the first book was basically fundamental information and philosophy about alchemy, the kind of foundation information you need in order just to understand the conversation about the subject. And the second book is on plant alchemy or plant spagyrics, which is usually the first thing that would be taught to somebody who had started training formally with somebody who had been trained themselves formally. Most organizations that I'm aware of, or individuals that I'm aware of, who have taught alchemy in the past in a formal structure would start with teaching the plant work, because it's safer, it's simpler, and it's a good way of learning all the basics of things like what equipment is required, how long things take to work with and work out, and the basic philosophy and the terminology used, because they're all very specific to alchemy, even though bits and pieces of it are found in other Western Hermetic subjects. Alchemy has a very specific way of using its terminology and its concepts because it's related directly to very practical things. And there's one of the things I think I point out in the book is that in the last 2,000 years of literature on alchemy, it's probably difficult to find more than half a dozen books that have been written on the subject of plant alchemy, even though there's literally thousands of books written on the subject of laboratory alchemy. So it's something that hasn't been talked about very much. And out of those half a dozen books, probably 3 or 4 of them have been written in the last 30 years. So it's a subject which has really only started to be understood now by people who are applying themselves to an understanding of the subject. So most of those books focus almost entirely on the technical aspect of actually carrying out the process of dealing with a plant alchemically. Very few of them touch in any detail on the theory and the philosophy behind all of the things which you learn through doing the laboratory work. Most people who teach the subject probably hope that by practicing in the lab that you'll pick up the details of the theory and the philosophy as you go. But in my experience, that doesn't really happen, because there's such a wide variety of beliefs and ways of understanding the deeper theory and philosophy of alchemy. The subject is terribly confusing, especially to new people. I know it was to me when I very first started. At the same time, a lot of people don't like to discuss their personal beliefs or opinions or understanding of the theory or philosophy because it's something that's argued about a lot, especially online. So one of the things I wanted to do, one of the main focuses of that second book was to explain how I was taught about the theory and philosophy and the concepts which I developed over the years about those aspects of studying alchemy for people who didn't really have a properly structured view of the ideas of the theory and philosophy. One of the things I find very terrible about Western Hermeticism in general is that as soon as people run out of an understanding of Western theory and practice of any Hermetic subject, they immediately switch to overlaying Eastern technical terms, concepts, and they don't always match very well. There seems to be a general belief that somehow Eastern concepts are more accurate or work better than Western. And so if you're looking for a default understanding, that you should go back to an Eastern standard. I don't personally believe that that's an accurate way of looking at things. And I think it also undermines a good search into the Western tradition for those answers themselves. Because often in the West, the way we have understood things in the past, which might not have been very well understood in modern times, brings a lot of clarity into the subject in general that doesn't normally exist. So I try to avoid defaulting back to an Eastern view of things and bringing up the subject of a lot of ideas from Western Hermeticism, which are either not known about or are misunderstood today. So that was my main theme with that book. Not so much to describe the manual process of dealing with plant substances in alchemy, which I do anyway, but to describe why those things were done and the way that alchemists of the classic era thought about those processes and ideas themselves when they were building a complete picture of the philosophy of alchemy. And I also add a couple of things at the end there, which are almost never talked about. On the subject of the primum ens melissa, which is a rejuvenative, and on the subject of rejuvenation itself, which few people are willing to discuss anything about, few people know anything about, and which is worth just talking about, I think, because a lot of people who come to alchemy come because they're curious about things like rejuvenation and transmutation. And they don't get a lot of answers to questions about things like that.
No, unfortunately not. I want to talk about this idea of in the modern times in the West, certainly in esotericism today, there's an idea that it's possible to make progress without a teacher and sometimes without even an established path or tradition. And you basically make mincemeat of that idea in your book. And I just wonder if you could talk a little bit more about this necessity of having a teacher and of being connected with an established tradition in order to make progress in esotericism generally and certainly in alchemy specifically.
Okay. This is something I end up talking a lot about to people because as you say, it's kind of you could almost say it's taken for granted by a lot of people that a teacher isn't necessary today because there's a lot of information available to people. And it's also a subject that a lot of people get a little bit precious about, because they don't, well, for a number of reasons, but there are two main reasons why I insist that a teacher is necessary when it comes to alchemy, and I think hermeticism in general. The first reason is probably the most easiest to understand, and that is that it is generally accepted that most people who study alchemy come to the study of alchemy through reading classic literature on the subject and anything that they can find of modern literature on the subject which is respected. And the problem with that is that is generally widely accepted that classic alchemical literature was written by adepts for adepts. It wasn't written by people who were experts in alchemy for people who were learning so that they can learn from the books. It's a common misunderstanding by people who are new to the subject that they think, oh, there's all these books and they have recipes and long explanations of concepts and philosophy theory. So I'll just read the books and work it out from there. But even the adepts themselves in classic literature regularly refer to the concept that these books are written by experts for experts, and that there must be a certain amount of humor attached to the idea that other people are reading them, non-experts are reading them, and becoming extremely confused by them, because pretty much I think anybody who has read any kind of classic literature on alchemy will agree that they are extremely confusing.
Yeah.
At one point you'll think, oh yeah, I know what this guy's talking about, I understand this, and 5 minutes later you'll be thinking, oh, I thought I understood and now it's off somewhere else completely different. One of the things I have found over the years is that when you talk to people who are new, relatively new to the subject, and you explain to them some of the things that these texts actually mean, they would have had no idea. Trying to figure it out themselves would have been just impossible, basically. And I remember back when I was first studying alchemy, and my own teacher had a large library of rare alchemical books, and I would spend a lot of time poring over those books and reading them, and I understood almost next to nothing that was being explained in the more serious literature. And so looking back over my own problems with trying to understand things, I can sympathize with the position of people who are now today new to the subject and are struggling with doing the same thing, thinking that they're going to figure it all out by reading books. And you simply can't. It's virtually impossible. And those books, not only written by adepts for adepts, but they're also designed to be very cunningly cryptic and not to be understood, and also to encourage you to misunderstand things. So people who haven't immersed themselves in the tradition as deeply as some people who study the subjects virtually have no chance in hell of understanding really much about the subject at all just from reading books. So that's the first thing. If you want to understand even basic fundamental concepts about alchemy, reading books will probably do next to nothing for you. You need somebody to explain, first of all, how that literature came about, the kind of mechanisms that are in the literature designed to fool people, and how to understand the technical language that's used. And it's something that our modern minds don't understand, really, because we take modern literature very literally, whereas it's more subjective back in the classic era. The second thing is the reason why I insist that a teacher is required is not as easy to understand by somebody who hasn't been in a position to sort of have a practical experience of this. But I might say that alchemy itself, the actual process of alchemy, is like a mechanism that exists in nature. If you can imagine that we know that all objects in our environment are constructed of atoms, but we can't see the atoms. And until somebody either theoretically or actually figured out that atoms existed and proved the fact, that looking at any object in our environment up until that point, most people would never have guessed that everything could be broken down into an object which is not only very simple but is universal, that the atom is a universal, like a little machine from which everything else is built up. Well, alchemy is like that too. Alchemy exists inside everything. It's kind of like the rules by which things come into existence, by which things are maintained, and then by which they decompose and leave existence. It's sort of like the machine which runs reality, just like an atom is a machine which forms the basis of the structure. Now, in order for people in past times, before modern science existed, to have understood that alchemy had that relationship with our reality, they must have had access to a level of comprehension which is uncommon. So the way they discussed that situation was, and the way it's usually presented in classic literature, was that there was only two ways that you'll understand alchemy. One is being taught by somebody who already understands it. In other words, someone who already has that level of comprehension, or by divine revelation. In other words, something happens to you that allows you to have that level of comprehension yourself. So in order to gain that level of comprehension, something unusual, extremely unusual has to happen, and very rare has to happen to you, or you have to talk to somebody who has had that rare and unusual thing happen to them in order for the reality of alchemy to present itself to you in an accurate manner. Traditionally, the way that that concept is described is that a person who is going to attain that unusual and rare level of comprehension must first go be initiated into Hermeticism. In other words, they have to be trained by somebody to alter their mind into a state that can comprehend the mechanism of alchemy that lies behind the obvious side of our reality. In other words, there's a process that can be applied to somebody, taught to them, that they can be trained in, that will alter their mentality in such a way that they can access a level of comprehension that can see alchemy operating in nature directly. In modern terms, the word that is most commonly used for that is gnosis. If you're somebody who actually has had that experience, a Gnostic experience, accurately, one of the first things you're going to come to realize is that there is a machine behind nature that nature operates on, and that machine, if you understand what alchemy is, conforms to the laws of alchemy. And that's what alchemy is. It is the laws and the process that machine functions under. So if in past times you either have had to head that unusual state of consciousness yourself, or talk to somebody who already had it in order to get an accurate understanding of alchemy, then the problem is, if you approach alchemy without owning that state yourself and without access to somebody who has that state, then virtually you're not going to understand the subject. You're going to look at the subject and you're going to judge it on the merits of common understanding, not that unusual, rare glimpse behind nature. And we see this today in modern alchemy. If you subscribe to any modern alchemical forums, like the Yahoo forums, and listen to people talk. There are a lot of people on those forums who approach alchemy from a very scientific point of view and are absolutely sure that anything that can be understood by physics and chemistry can be explained in the language and in the paradigm of physics and chemistry. And so they attempt to understand alchemy. If alchemy is real, then it must be subject to those sciences. And so they're trying to use a commonly understood, relatively speaking, commonly understood paradigm to understand a subject which comes from a paradigm which is not common. To bridge that gap, the thing that they're missing, and of course the thing that most people don't understand that they're missing, is that higher level of comprehension, which they haven't achieved themselves, or which they are not discussing with somebody who has achieved themselves. It's a peculiar situation that if you don't have that state of consciousness or aren't discussing it with somebody who has it, then it virtually would not even occur to you that such a state existed, because common mentality, common ability to rationalize the nature of life seems like a complete package, relatively speaking, but the fact is it's not. It's a limited package. So that's the second reason why it's important to have a teacher, and not just any teacher, but if you want to learn alchemy accurately, you need to have a teacher who possesses that unusual, rare level of comprehension himself, so that he can relate to you how alchemy actually exists and functions in nature. It's not just enough to say, here's a book, this is what the guy says, follow these instructions, because you won't reach it that way. It needs another level of filling in between the lines, basically, by somebody who has seen the mechanics of alchemy in nature firsthand.
Yeah, I think that is a big distinction. This is the way I see it, and correct me if I'm wrong, but what I see is that there are a lot of teachers of laboratory alchemy who seem, from my ignorant perspective, to be competent, but the depth of the theoretical explanations for the operations are lacking for someone in my position, I think, to really grasp what's going on. That's why I find your book to be such a revelation, because I can actually pick it up and get an actual glimpse, I think, of what is really going on, which, regardless of the number of books I read, as you said, I never really quite grasped. You mentioned this idea of a gnosis, of a way of perceiving the alchemical process in nature. Could you talk a little bit more about that? Because if I'm not mistaken, in your book, you basically allude to the fact that those with this gnosis, their perception of this alchemical process going on may not be simply a sixth sense perception.
Oh, that's certainly true. Most people who teach alchemy and look to be proficient in a subject have simply manually by rote been taught the manual processes of dealing with substances, glassware, in a laboratory. So it's easy for them to then say, this is a retort, this is such and such a plant, this is alcohol, this is what we do with it. That's simple, and it's the most superficial level of teaching of alchemy. But the thing which betrays that they're lacking that deeper level of understanding is the moment you say, well, what does all this mean? And immediately then they become uncomfortable because they have to defer to guesswork, largely, or opinion which stands on shaky ground. And you know immediately that they actually haven't perceived that mechanism in nature itself, and therefore understand it as clearly as a mechanic would understand how an internal combustion engine works. They have to guess at it, basically. Mm. So for the first two books, and in the third one, which will probably be published early next year, or maybe towards the end of this year. I've hinted away at the subject quite a bit without actually saying very much about it at all, because I don't want that idea to detract from the other things that are being said in the book and cause people to think that it would be difficult for them to study alchemy if they didn't have access to that concept. It's important when approaching alchemy first to build up enthusiasm about the subject rather than just decide, oh, well, if I can't find a person who already has this insight, well, then it's a waste of time, because it's not necessarily. Being involved in it to some degree could be the very thing that causes you to come into contact with somebody who has that extra insight. So the fifth book at the end of the series will be the one that discusses this concept. And because you've asked about it, I'll kind of try to encapsulate that in a smaller explanation as I can. And even though this book comes at the end of the series, one of the things that I say in that book is that in the process of training somebody, ideally, that part comes at the beginning, because it's necessary for you to possess that level of insight yourself before you be taught the lab work. Otherwise, it's almost a pointless exercise. Almost. So the only way that I know of accurately explaining the situation is to refer to Kabbalistic terminology, which I think most people listening to this podcast will probably have at least a rudimentary understanding of. Mm-hmm. The average human mind is built up of three functions, which the Kabbalists refer to as the Ruach, and that's the thinking objective mind that looks out at the world, recognizes objects in the world and situations and makes judgments about them and therefore plans in order that a person can then figure out how to survive in the world. And that's the Ruach. The counterpart to the Ruach is the Nefesh, which Kabbalists refer to as the animal soul, which is like the subjective mind and which modern psychologists refer to as the unconscious. It's where habit arises from, where memory is stored. And another, it's the larger part of the mind too. The Ruach is actually a small function compared to the Nefesh. And the third function is a thing that Jung referred to as the shadow, and which Hermetic tradition refers to as either the dweller on the threshold or the guardian on the threshold. These three functions together make up the human personality, basically. And the important thing about these three functions is that the Nefesh and Ruach represent two poles of the mind in conflict with each other. They're both essential to human existence because one is feeling and one is thinking, basically. But they are in disagreement about the nature of reality and how it should be dealt with. And that's the basic nature of human nature, is that it's in conflict. It's always seeking answers. It's always looking for a balance between things, and that's what it perceives to be the best state to exist in. So we're constantly hankering after it. Then we have a level of the mind which is beyond human state of mind, the personality, which the Kabbalists also compose of three chunks called the neshama, or understanding, and the chia, or willpower, higher willpower, and the yakida, which is everything in harmony. It's a state of unity in the mind where no two things are separate from each other. Everything exists in one place, in one state. There is no back and forward, no yesterday and today, no black and white, no day and night. Everything exists in one state. So one of the things Kabbalists tell us about these two separate triads of parts of the mind is that one is temporary, and that's the personality. It gets created at the beginning of each life and exists to basically ensure a person can function in life productively. And the higher triad exists virtually eternally. And the important thing about the higher triad of the Neshama, the Chia, and the Yukita is that that's where the function or the mechanism of alchemy resides. And that the first people who understood that function, who recognized it in nature, were people who must have had a connection with that level of the mind. The process of initiation is one that takes a person who exists largely in the lower triad and makes a connection between the lower and the higher triad. And that's all that initiation basically is, the ability to take a person who exists in a normal state of humanity and create a connection between their everyday living state of consciousness, the Ruach, the Nefesh, and the Nakash, which is the Jungian shadow, and link it to the higher functions. And the moment that that happens, a new level of mentality develops. At first, just a little bit, and then the more that that link is encouraged and increased, that higher function of mentality basically takes over the mind and possesses the individual. And that's what we commonly call a state of illumination. And the reason why it's referred to as a state of illumination is that it basically fills in all of the gaps in the way a normal person thinks. Things which would seem like a paradox to a normal person become a clear state of reasoning, an orderly form of logic at a higher level when they're looked at with the higher functions. And that difference, that ability to see what seems like a paradox to a normal person as an orderly, complete concept from the higher functions, is what makes a difference between someone who approaches alchemy from a chemist or a physicist point of view and just can't figure out why they can't figure out things. And someone who approaches a subject from the point of view of an initiate and suddenly realizes that's because they're missing A part, B part, C part. And when you put those into the equation, the whole thing works out properly and seems very obvious and clear in the end. Somebody who exists in that lower state has no idea generally about the higher state, except for maybe a small number of times in their life by accident something might happen to them, which causes a connection to open up between the lower functions and the higher functions. And for a short time, they experience what it's like to think with those higher functions and see that as a state of illumination, but it usually disappears pretty quickly. Mm. So one of the peculiar things about seeing reality from the state of the higher functions is when you have hindsight then, and you can say, oh, okay, there are two states of thinking, of mentality that exist. But until you've attained that second state, the first state seems very like a complete package, and that everything that we require to understand the world, the nature of our reality, should be in that package, but it isn't. It's incomplete. So that's really the role that a proper teacher plays. He has that bridge already, and he knows how to give it to somebody else.
Yeah, it's really quite a conundrum because, as you said, the lower or the reasonable mind tends to think it can grasp everything and understand it and categorize it and make sense of it all.
That's right.
And it doesn't even realize maybe that there is something beyond it. So it is, it's quite a conundrum. But I appreciate your explanation because I feel like it goes further towards the justification and explanation of the necessity of a teacher more so than simply saying it's just not possible, it's not, you can't make legitimate progress. I mean, all these things may be true, but I feel like you've really crystallized why that's the case. So
the one thing that really defines the situation is somebody with that extra level of comprehension can teach accurate alchemy to somebody without it. Like I could take you tomorrow, put you in a lab and say, this is how you make the philosopher's stone, take this, take that, do this to it, do that to it, and at the end it will work out for you as well as it will work out for me. The difference is you won't understand why.
Mm-hmm.
And it's the understanding that is the point in the whole thing. Right. There's no point in doing the whole process if you don't understand it in the end, but you have this thing that can produce gold. So what? You have gold, you make money, and you live as a wealthy person in the world. But at the end, you die, and you're in the same situation as everybody else. The thing that makes the difference is the understanding. And you can't have that without the insight, that extra level of insight that's required. Even if somebody explains that higher level to you, you won't be able to grasp it because you don't have the actual mental mechanism that's required to join the dots, basically.
Just as an aside, I mean, I'm sure this is probably the case for most people, but I find that as I go through your book and thinking about this, the greater implications of it are really striking to me. Maybe we can talk a little bit more about that later on.
Okay.
I just want to quote from the book to draw back to what you were talking about before in terms of the higher state of consciousness that a teacher may possess and how this faculty with regard to alchemy really has come down through the ages. You write, and this is, I think, on pages 45 and 46, once the early alchemists had learned of the intelligence principle in matter, they developed a form of psychological technology that allowed them to investigate the properties of matter from the opposite pole to that approached by modern physics and chemistry. With their own minds, the ancient alchemists could read the mind of matter and perceive therein the very instructions that form and drive matter. I'm still not quite sure I'm fully grasping the implications of that, and I'm just wondering if you could tell us a little bit more about that.
If you could imagine that directly behind physical matter is like a field from which physical matter arises, so like a quantum field from which the pieces that make up atoms emerge out of and go back into quantum mechanics recognizes that such a state exists, although it hasn't really been identified or categorized, partly because it exists behind physical matter. It can't be measured by physical technical equipment. That field is what alchemists refer to as the anima mundi, or it's like the mind of the world. Jungian psychology calls it the collective unconscious. And one of the important things about the collective unconscious is that it's like the memory of nature. And while we're all alive and living our lives, everything that we interact with, everything that we perceive, even things that we're not consciously aware of, are recorded in our personal unconscious. Even things we see out the corner of our eye, every tint of color in our environment, every smell that we're not physically aware of, the whole lot's recorded. But the most important things that are recorded are our interactions with our environment, what we think and what we feel about them and how we behave towards them. So it's like a hard drive, our unconscious recording everything. And we could say that the anima mundi, or the mind of the world, the collective unconscious, is like a mainframe. As each person stores their collective memories, those collective memories are being uploaded to the mainframe as one entire collective memory of the race, and sorted out, the garbage is discarded, and the essence of all of that is collected together so that the pattern of every behavior, the way 7 billion people can deal with something as simple as water, is recorded in the collective unconscious and has been going on for as long as humanity has existed. So the amount of information that is stored there about a simple thing like how do you deal with water is enormous. If you could access that information with your mind, there wouldn't be anything about water that it was possible to understand that you couldn't understand. And every facet of our reality is stored like that in the collective unconscious. when something arrives in this reality, like, for example, when two animals conceive to give birth and that fetus starts to develop, the information that tells the cells how they must arrange themselves, the parts that they're composed of, how they will function, how they divide, that information is stored in the mainframe of the race. And at some point, the essence of it, the blueprint of that information, is shunted into the individual person, and their life develops based on that blueprint. That it's like a piece of software that says this is how you grow and develop and this is how you deal with your reality. So there's an interesting guy called Rupert Sheldrake. He's a biologist who wrote a lot about the subject of what he called biogenesis and was pretty much treated like a quack by the academic community. But I think his concepts are becoming more widely accepted now. And he basically said the same thing, that somewhere behind nature is a record of how things exist and function, how they are maintained, but how they grow and develop as well. And that whenever any biological organism springs into reality, it accesses that information field, which tells it how to develop. And he called that process biogenesis. So he basically has come up with a concept which is really very old, because Hermesism recognizes the same thing. The whole concept of things like angels and archangels and demons and all that are basically just software that are part of that biogenetic program. They've had information stored in them from the collective experience of humanity, and they feed it back in a loop to all developing organisms, basically. So that really is... about the simplest way I can answer your question is that nature has a memory, and it's not only stores everything that we experience, but it feeds it back to us in an orderly kind of functioning way. But because evolution hasn't completed its path, there are problems with the information. Even at the most extreme level, there are still dysfunctions, so that when a new organism comes into the world and develops, things go wrong with it. And you could say that evolution is a process of working out those problems, fixing the dysfunctions that are being collected in the collective unconscious and the anima mundi. And that's one of the places where, when an enlightened alchemist has access to that higher level of understanding, one of the things he's doing is accessing that level of reality. He's seeing into the collective memory of the race. And he can see there as well as you can see by looking out your window across the street at people walking up and down exactly how things function. In an age when modern technology didn't exist, further back in history we go, the only toy that illuminated people had to play with really was their own mind. And there was nothing stopping them from developing their mind, investigating it to the absolute extreme levels that they did. When you have castes of priests in almost every culture in the ancient world who basically were fed and clothed and sheltered by the state, and all they had to do was sit around all day investigating their mind, they obviously discovered some very extreme and interesting things about the nature of reality that today we're only just now beginning to recognize exist and to start investigating ourselves. And some of that past experience is where things like alchemy and magic came from in the beginning. They recognized things about the nature of reality that you can't see with the naked eye, things that modern science doesn't know because it's investigating from the opposite end of the loop, where it's approaching the mystery of reality from the physical end of the loop.
Personally, I feel like science as a discipline has a need to discredit alchemy and magic and ancient wisdom traditions, not in terms of the theory so much as the mechanism that causes them to be effective, because my sense is that as a society, we're threatened by the idea that we're not, quote unquote, progressing. What are your thoughts about that?
The entire body of knowledge developed concerning esoteric subjects like alchemy and magic developed at a time in human history when the Kabbalistic Nefesh was still developing. And those, because the Nefesh was developing and because the human race was learning to use that mental function to its, stretch it and push it in every direction to its absolute extremes, the end result of that was things like magic and alchemy. But for a long time now, probably since well before the fall of the Roman Empire, the other side of the mind is our nature, our personal development is focused on the Ruach, and science is a development of the Ruach. If you understand what the Ruach is and you have experienced what it is intimately, you understand its exact nature, it is completely focused on the physical, and its job is to learn everything that it can about the physical in order for the individual to function most productively in the physical. And science is a natural development of that. Science wants to believe that it will grasp everything about physical nature so that at the end of that search, there won't be anything more to learn, and therefore what we understand about the physical will allow us to be masters of physical reality. That's how the Ruach believes. That's its approach to life. It's constantly observing and pulling things apart and thinking about them and forming concepts and philosophies, making all kinds of judgments about everything it perceives in order to master physical reality. And science is basically, at a larger level, collective level, is the result of that. It's that pushed to the most extreme. And one of the things that the Ruach in its development has naturally become or inherently possesses is a dislike for the internal world, because its natural function looks outward to the physical world and its job is to master the physical world. It virtually denies the internal world. If you watch people and if you pay attention to them, and even particularly if you discuss with them about their own minds, the average person knows virtually nothing about their mind and they care less. They think dreams are just an aberration of the mind, like a form of entertainment. And the voice in their head that they hear every day while they're thinking, they don't even really think about what that voice could possibly be, why it speaks the same language as them, the kind of things that it thinks and where it's taking them. So the average person really knows virtually nothing about their own mind, and they care less about it. And they certainly are very skeptical and often afraid of anybody who does know something about the mind. And this is because the Ruach, which governs our society basically, doesn't like anything internal, because it can't pin it down, put a label on it, and measure it, and wrap it up in a clean package in order to add it to its store of information that it knows about the world. All it naturally wants to do is observe the physical world. And so science is, that attitude of the Ruach has shifted to science as well. Science doesn't want to know anything about the internal world. It wants to write it off as being a waste of time or a delusion or an aberration or something which really doesn't matter in the larger scheme of trying to figure out and master life, basically.
Thank you for that explanation. Could you define, I'm sorry, I'm going to mispronounce it again, Spagyria? I know that's a simple question, but I'm fairly certain that the answer is not.
It's actually a good question, because recently, about 5 or 8 years ago, a guy who was quite widely respected in the alchemical community online decided that he was going to define the word Spagyrix or Spagyria as meaning an attempt, something along the lines of an attempt at practicing alchemy, but not getting it right because you don't know all the facts. So it's like an honest intention of getting the thing right, but not because you don't really know the facts about the matter. Mm-hmm. What he was trying to do was something which is understandable, and that was to make a clear definition between superficial alchemy and actually understanding the philosophic side, the kind of things we've already been discussing. And he wanted a word that would describe the superficial side of alchemy, and for some reason he decided that Spagyrix was the word. It's an old word, and it's said to have been coined by Paracelsus, who used who created the word by joining two Greek root words, speo and agrero, which means to separate and to bind, which is kind of the key formula of alchemical practice, where you take something like a plant and you separate it into its principles or elements, and you purify those elements and you recombine them into a unit again. Paracelsus wanted a word other than alchemy for some reason to explain that situation, so he coined the word Spagyric. And he, true to his time, he used the Greek language to express that word, and he discussed that word in his writings many, many times. And there's one particular place which I quote in my books where he explains that the word alchemy as being a description or a label for that mechanism in nature, and the word Spagyric are the same thing. They're not different. They're not one word meaning an attempt to be alchemical but failing because you don't know the real secrets, which is a term that's been spread around today. So now you have a whole bunch of people who are very confused. You know, people who understand what Paracelsus meant by that term and don't accept the idea that the word Spagyric means a failed attempt at practicing alchemy. And you have a whole lot of people who are reasonably new to the study of alchemy who have picked up on that cliche of using the word Spagyric to mean basically a good intention at practicing alchemy but failing because you don't really know the real secrets of it. So it's actually a good question because there is a lot of confusion concerning it. And it is basically a label for the machinery of alchemy or the mechanism of alchemy, which is a formula that you apply to anything that you want to produce an alchemical product from in the end, which is what alchemy is all about. Alchemy isn't about just taking any old plants or animal bits or minerals or metals or whatever and doing whatever you like to them. It's a very specific process that's applied to a substance in order to attain very specific goals. So, for example, while there may be other ways of producing the Philosopher's Stone, such as the people who are involved with the Orms movement claim that they have another way of dealing with things, but they want to be calling it alchemy because they want to take on to themselves the kudos, the atmosphere of alchemical tradition, it's a different method. And even if it does achieve the same goals, it does produce an elixir of life and a transmutation agent, it is a different method. Alchemy is a specific method. And so when we apply that word or the word Spagyrix to a formula or an operation for producing transmutation agents or rejuvenatives, we're talking about a very specific way of doing it, whereas something like the methods that are used by the people who are involved in the Orms movement, they may be achieving the same goals, but they're using a different way of going about it. Therefore, it's not alchemy, and it's not Spagyrix. That doesn't mean it's wrong or that it's invalid. It just means that they're applying a technical term to the wrong thing.
Well, thank you for that explanation. One of the things you talk about in the book, to return to it again, is this idea of the prima materia, the first matter. And again, I think you dispel some illusions about what the first matter is and what the first matter is not. And I'm just wondering if you could say a few words about that.
Amongst a lot of people who like to feel that they've studied the subject extensively and come to understand it, there's a general understanding that the term prima materia refers to the thing that you take out of nature. It's lying on the ground or it's in a cave somewhere or whatever, that you begin the process of working on the philosopher's stone with. Because prima materia means the first matter. So they think it's the first thing that you take, but it actually doesn't mean that at all. And a number of respected alchemists who claim to have succeeded in the process and claim to have an inside understanding of the process even say it's not the thing that you first take to begin the work. It's actually the thing that is the first thing that matter grows out of. That's why it's called the prima materia, the very first matter, the raw proto-substance from which reality grows, basically. It's like we were talking about before, that underlying field or quantum field of reality from which atoms and their particles spring and fall back into. So the way alchemists often talk about this is that they say you cannot begin the work to achieve the philosopher's stone until you have the prima materia. So it makes it sound like it's the first thing you're going to do. You need to go out and you need to find it's a rock or it's a metal of some kind or a state of metallic evolution or something like that. It's going to be lying around somewhere in the earth or on the earth or something like that, but it's not. What they know and what a few of those guys have said is that you take a substance in nature and then you basically reverse engineer it back to that original state. Because one of the things that they say about the prima materia, people who know what they're talking about, is that that substance can be found in everything and everywhere. And it only describes one thing, really. It's like that quantum field that's behind everything else. And what they're saying about that quantum field is that there is a substance in the physical world at the core of everything, which is the basis of everything. It's like the foundations of a building, that if you reverse engineer any matter, like a rock or a metal or a plant or a mineral or anything like that, back to the simplest, most basic thing that you can get to in their age, not now, because that's a different story now, you'll reach a substance that is a base substance of everything. It's what every metal, every mineral grows out of, and therefore every plant and every animal. It's the basis and point of everything. That's the prima materia. So what the old alchemist said is you can't actually begin the work to make the philosopher's stone until you figure out what that thing is, and until you also work out how to take a substance, a natural thing like copper or lead, and reverse engineer it back to that substance. Once you've figured that much out, then everything else pretty much fits together neatly and you can figure out the rest of the process moving forward again. So the first step in the alchemical process is to reduce the crude matter, the thing that you take from nature, back to its prima materia. And another word that's used for that is the chaos of the elements, or the hail of the Greeks. It's the very first thing which a substance grows out of. And it's a substance, say like if it's a plant that we're working on, if we are making a plant elixir from a rosemary bush. A rosemary bush has its version of that prima materia. And before we can do anything else, that plant has to be reverse engineered back to that state. And once you hit that state, then you can now come forward again and perform the alchemical process on it. So it's a technical thing, mm-hmm. which few people understand because they misunderstand the basic comment, which is before you can begin the work, you must first attain the prima materia. So they think it's a cryptic enigma for you have to figure out what the first thing is that you take. In a way, that's true, but it's not what they think it is. It's not the physical, natural thing. It's a substance at the base of that physical thing, which is found everywhere and in everything. So technically, the Philosopher's Stone or a quintessence can be produced from anything, because that substance or that prima materia state is in everything. And quantum mechanics agrees with that view, with that concept.
This quintessence, and getting from the prima materia to the quintessence, is quite a process in and of itself. And I think, if I'm not mistaken, from my understanding of your book, there are also similar misunderstandings about the quintessence that one may be attempting to work towards as well, not just with prima materia. Is that true?
It sounds like you've actually understood at least the basics of it yourself anyway, that once you have the prima materia, which is a unified substance, it's like that quantum field where there is no difference between one thing and another thing. A state of chaos where the elements are mixed and can't be defined separately in that state. And that the quintessence at the other end of the formula is also a unified substance in which the elements or the principles can't be separately defined. It's homogeneous. And that's kind of the basic philosophy between the whole thing. You have to go back to that unified state by finding the prima materia to begin the process. And the problem with that prima materia is that it encapsulates in itself dysfunction. There's something corrupt about it, because if we're going to use a biblical term, its fall into physical reality has caused it to take on an aspect of its nature which is slightly dysfunctional. And so what the alchemist wants to do is he wants to take that prima materia and fix that dysfunction, and then stick all the bits back together again and reproduce the prima materia, but now at a higher level where the dysfunction has been removed from it. The famous Arab alchemist Geber, or Jaber, made a statement in one of his books where he said about alchemy in general, that our matter is one thing, the work is one thing, the flask is one thing, and all we do is remove, we don't need to add anything to the process or to the thing, but all we have to do is remove that which is superfluous. And basically what he was saying is that when you get to that one thing, the prima materia, all you have to do is remove the dysfunctional part and stick all the bits back together again so that they're homogeneous. They form a unit, which is what I refer to as the Q state or the quintessence. And then you have the same thing that you began with, but with the dysfunction removed. And so now it exists at a higher level. And what that means is, because the dysfunction isn't there, that thing becomes a medicine. It expresses the natural, harmonious, and unified state of the source, if you like. It's like the original pattern or blueprint without any faults in it. So then, for example, if you ingest that thing, it's going to overpower that same problem inside yourself and knock you into a state of balance yourself. And that's basically how rejuvenation and transmutation work. That state of that thing with its dysfunction removed is so powerful that it will absolutely override the same substance in its dysfunctional state and correct it automatically. And you only need a tiny little wee bit of it in a fixed state, in its pure quintessent state, to add back to the original dysfunctional object, and it will completely fix it and cause it to throw off the dysfunctional part of itself. And that's basically how rejuvenation works and transmutation. The Philosopher's Stone is basically just gold with its dysfunction removed. So when you throw it into another metal that is in a molten state, because metals are all evolving up to the state of gold, it will alter the state of that metal cause it to throw off its dysfunctional nature, and then it will rearrange itself in a new pattern, which is pure gold, basically, 24-karat gold. Or if a person eats it, you know, it's going to cause them to expel all of the toxins from their system, all of their dysfunctional thinking, all of their dysfunctional habits will basically be vomited out of their system, and they will come out the other end illuminated.
Hmm. It's fascinating. I definitely want to talk more about rejuvenation and the ingestion of these alchemical substances, but you raised a point about this unity gold, and it reminds me of this saying, the ancient alchemist, I guess, this saying, our stone and the sun are one. Now, initially, I understood that from a more Kabbalistic, symbolic perspective. I'm using gematria and different things. But based on what you're saying, though, this is not an allegorical, symbolical statement only. This is a real thing as well.
Yeah, that's a defining thing. It is both an allegory or a metaphor or a symbolic state, but it is also a physical thing. And the physical thing is an analog of the non-physical thing. Something that a lot of people who claim to have studied a lot about Hermeticism completely failed to miss is that the Emerald Tablet, which is universally considered by Western occultists to sort of express the basic philosophy, the rules of the game, if you like. They all forget that one of the most well-known phrases in that statement is as above, so below. In other words, what's inside has a direct relationship with what's outside, or what's above in the spiritual level of reality is a direct relationship with what is physical. And you can't have one without the other. You can't have a physical object without the non-physical side existing there, the pattern that made it be here in the first place. And you can't have the pattern without the physical thing existing. The two are interdependent. They require each end of the pole to exist. It'd be like a magnet with only one pole, a monopole magnet. In nature, that doesn't exist. It's like you can't have a human without a mind. Mm-hmm. And alternatively, you can't have a mind without a human to operate through. It's like having a computer. You can't have the information for a computer and the software without actually having the hardware to store it on. It's the same thing, but interdependent. So, it's not just a metaphor or a symbol. It's an actual physical thing. Alchemically, there's a number of stories which are very hard to follow, and I actually don't understand them very well. I get the basics of the thing, but trying to follow it all through and piece all the bits together, that the radiation which leaves the sun and enters our atmosphere, the moment it enters our atmosphere, it actually creates a substance which is first of all non-physical and then becomes physical in the atmosphere. And because there's moisture in the atmosphere, that substance becomes dissolved in rain. And rain brings it to the surface of the earth, and then that substance becomes every single thing that's on the face of the earth. And this is the prima materia that exists everywhere and in everything. Its origin is actually in the sun, which it leaves the surface of the sun as a non-physical thing, probably a form of energy. And then when it enters our atmosphere, something about our atmosphere alters that energy and forces it to become a physical substance, which is the basis of all things. And alchemists see that as a very literal statement. They don't see it as being symbolic.
Mm. Well, I want to thank you again, Rubophilos. Again, the book is The Hermes Paradigm, Book 2, the first work published by Salamander and Sons, an absolutely amazing, revelatory book. Again, I highly recommend it. If you could just remind people how they can find you online, I think that would be good.
At the moment, I have a Facebook page under Rubophilos, so you can search for it on Facebook by searching for Rubophilos. My website is www.rubophilos.com, And although it's kind of a bit messy there, and I change things around a lot because it's sort of just like it's a bit of an art project, really, where I just like messing around with coding and HTML and putting some of my artwork up there. I do put a lot of my ideas and everything up there, and a lot of new ideas that I come up with, the concepts that I'm working on, I put up there. And there's also information there about how to contact me and how to get involved in tuition if you want to. There's not a lot of information about the training we give there, but if you're considering it and thinking about it, you contact me. I'll send you a document that we prepared which explains everything that we require from a new student, what the qualifications are basically, and what we offer in the way of training. I also moderate the Alchemy International Alchemy Guild's Yahoo group for anybody who likes Yahoo groups and talking on them. You can find me there often whenever anybody bothers to actually talk, discussing my ideas and talking about the things. And there's a lot of people on that forum, about nearly 500 people, I think, but there's not a lot of talking these days there. Yahoo forums have almost reached the end of their usefulness, I think.
Yeah, I would agree. Well, for reasons that don't concern us, I think that is a problem that escalates over time.
Yeah.
Unfortunately. But I hope people will read your book and contact you if they're interested, because really I've found no better teacher of alchemy, a writer about alchemy, and just from two relatively slim volumes, I feel like you have already transformed the landscape of the alchemical tradition. Great work. Congratulations. And I hope we can talk again at some point in the future.
Thanks again.
Yeah, thank you. It's been a pleasure and an honor to speak with you.
Please join Rubophilos and I in the Occult of Personality membership section for more discussion of alchemy, including some extraordinary anecdotes about rejuvenation through alchemical means. This was one of the most revealing and surprising conversations on the subject that I've been fortunate enough to host. You won't want to miss it. Thanks again for listening, and until next time.